Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 5th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Christian Sharn. Today's session number is 98-4, and it's titled Worship and Ethics, the Hidden Language of Silence. Let's listen in.
Chris Sharon, and this is the fourth session of a course on worship and ethics. And this session is titled The Hidden Language of Silence. And this week has been a set of discussions based on this proposal, which I think is provocative and comes from this book by Don Salyer's Worship and Spirituality. The bookstore has it, and it's just an exploration of how worship shapes Christian life, shapes individuals and communities in Christian life. And the particular proposal from this book that I drew out was this one: in order for liturgy to form us well in the practices of faith, we must learn the hidden languages of worship. The reason I thought this would be provocative for discussion not only is based on the fact that we don't often think about the hidden languages, the four that I've considered this week, certainly not all the hidden languages, but the four that we consider this week are time, space, today silence, and then tomorrow gesture. Others have been suggested to me, taste and smell. There's all sorts of nonverbal parts of our gathering and worship together that affect our participation and affect our sense of God and our sense of the community's wholeness and affect our sense of ourselves and our integrity. So, just starting at the bottom, I thought the hidden languages would be an interesting thing to focus on. Why focus on those? Well, I think from our summer theme book, Practicing Our Faith, that if we talk about Christianity as a set of practices, a set of things that we do both as individuals and as communities, such as offering hospitality to others — Esther's Bible studies this week have been on meals of hospitality — and you could think of eating together as a practice of Christian living, and doing that well depends on certain factors, I'm arguing, that are part of these hidden languages: the space, the time. If one doesn't take enough time, it's hard to practice hospitality well. So there's an interconnection, I'm arguing, between the way these hidden languages shape us and our communities and doing these practices of the Christian faith well. The forming us is the way in which I want to talk about ethics, that typically, in the first day of our course this week, we talked about a very common view of ethics being do, don't, right, wrong, typical sort of rules approach to ethics. And I wanted to not focus so much on what the person should do, but on the person and what shapes the person. And that traditionally is referred to as character ethics, and it is concerned with the question of formation. And I think that's a really appropriate way to talk about the relationship between worship and ethics, because if you think about worship, except for maybe the sermon, there aren't many things in worship that tell you, do this, don't do that. It's more subtle and it's more effective over time. It's not something that if a person just went to church one Sunday, they would immediately know all the right and wrong things to do as a Christian. So then liturgy, I'm proposing, isn't — I don't want to think too in-depth about that, but just propose that liturgy is a way of ordering our life. Liturgy is a patterning of worship. So even so-called non-liturgical churches have orders of worship and ways of patterning their life together. Even if you, say, go to a Free Church African-American worship service, there's certain formulaic patterns of language, oftentimes biblical language or language from certain hymns, that comes up again and again and tells the people that they're together and they're worshiping God and that they're giving thanks for that. So that's a bit of a unpacking of the proposal. And for today's session, in the pattern that I've been doing this week, I'm going to ask us to think together about where we see silence in our culture. One of the concerns I have today is that our culture is so strong in its if you want to say our culture forms us so powerfully, not only because of the preponderance of images, the television and magazine advertising, billboards. If you drive down a highway in a city or a suburban area, or even now in rural areas, there's billboards all over the place giving us a message. I want to talk about where, or if we don't find it, why we don't find silence in our culture now. And then where we find silence in worship. I think there may be some relationship between our culture's view of silence and what happens in our worship. And then ask, in conclusion, how would silence matter for doing these practices of faith well? So before we go into the question of silence in our culture, just any comments generally on the proposal or the issue of hidden languages? Any thoughts or comments?
Well, whispering isn't silence, mm-hmm. but there is something about being in a sick room with someone that's mm-hmm. very ill or near dying, that everyone has sort of subdued voices. And at a funeral or a wake, or not a wake, that's a celebration, I guess, but if you were visiting the funeral, I think when you're waiting for a very important person to give concert, or that the audience is usually the expectation of learning some great new thing. Mm-hmm.
That's a helpful segue into this question of silence in our culture, because I was thinking this morning about going to the symphony, and there's sort of rustling and coughing and so forth. And then there's this moment when somehow people know that the conductor is about to come out, and there's silence. And then pretty soon a door will open, the conductor walks out, and everyone, you know, breaks into applause. And that's an interesting moment in our society when we sort of have an unspoken rule that silence, as you're saying, honors the expectation of something important, that this person is coming to offer us something important. Yes?
I saw an early concert of Theodore McKell when he did a song about the Jonestown flood, I believe it was. And it was so striking and so horrifying in its content, and he did it so well that for about 3 minutes after he ended the song, there was absolute silence in the whole audience. And he said that he could not have been more honored by a standing ovation. Which he also does.
Right. But that complicates what we're saying a little bit, because it's not only silence honoring his ability, but also silence in a way honoring or just being in awe of the destructiveness of human beings, that terrible things can happen. Yeah. I have a professor who opens his systematic theology course with a propaganda film from Nazi Germany with the parades, and his point in that is to show how liturgical symbolism of processions and of banners and all can be turned unbelievably wrong. And usually there's just a big moment of silence after that, because the students aren't expecting that. So that's very interesting.
As far as the definition of silence, sounds like we were talking about billboards and so forth. You're going beyond just speaking or hearing it. There's just messages coming at you. Is that right? So billboards would not be silenced there.
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I guess I made that as an assumption, that when things are are speaking to me, they're not necessarily out loud. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't really thought that out, but I am making that assumption. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think as the basis for it, that's fine.
Yeah.
But make sure I understood it.
Yeah.
That's like a worship minister to the altar. That's almost silence.
Yeah.
We do it in silence, but visual silence or something.
Right. That's an interesting connection between this session and next, the way in which gesture is a language, gesture and movement are languages. Yeah.
I just had one comment that kind of struck me as you were talking about that. The hidden languages in worship and the protocols and so forth, yeah. As opposed to liturgy. You know, sometimes we think of liturgy as being a stumbling block to new people coming into the church.
Right.
But at least there's a roadmap for that.
Right.
When you think of these others as a stumbling block, when there's no roadmap, and it probably takes you years to learn them all,
right.
You know. But if somebody walks in new and they don't, you know, everybody stands up at the right time or whatever it is, you know, those are all the same kind of messages. So.
Right, they're just not printed anymore.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, are there this question about the that he's raised about the billboards in San Diego State now? And one thinks about being in a heavily neon section as being in a loud situation, even though it's appearing to the sense of sight. And often the cue to be silent is a dimming of the lights. I mean, if you're at a movie theater, it isn't just that they have to dim the lights to show the film. It's that we associate the absence of sound and sight, so that you think of nighttime as a quiet time.
Yeah.
When it gets dark,
right.
You just expect that darkness and quietness go together. So those two senses do kind of play off of one another in an interesting way. I'm not sure if it works, though it works in many contexts. If you're sitting in a worship space that's really heavily ornate, with massive stained glass windows and lots of, you're not in a kind of plain church tradition, but you're in a great cathedral, you somehow don't think of that as being loud, even though your senses are being, your visual senses are really being highly stimulated, but somehow in a different way than they're being stimulated in a neighborhood strip mall or something.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, is one of the differences when what the signs are doing is giving words, like one message, a narrow message that's intended to convince you of one specific thing, versus, say, stained glass windows could be multivalent and evocative and less clear in terms of trying to convince you of a message, like these obnoxious new cigarette advertisements I see all over Atlanta that are saying, well, we don't have any additives in our cigarettes, and so they say, loud, yeah. Yeah.
I think it's very rare to find a person that doesn't feel compelled to fill a real silence with some sort of visual or oral sound.
Is that a discomfort with silence that you're hinting at, or is it just...
I think people do pretty much have a great discomfort with silence.
That's why silence can be used as a sales tool or a negotiating tool.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes we'll say whoever breaks that silence first loses, so make your proposal and then just wait until perhaps the person you're selling to becomes uncomfortable and says, well,
Yeah, I'm interested.
So.
That's interesting.
In the court where I'm a member of a parish, they have the announcements the very first thing. And then we have a prelude for meditation. And really, no one would whisper or talk during the prelude, so it seems like that's a silent time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in our church when I was growing up, they used to sing the Lord, the choir would stand in back and sing, "The Lord is in his holy temple, let us be silent." And then it would get silence and silence, and then it would be quiet for a while. And I don't know why they've gotten away from that. I just thought of that, you know. But
students in my classes are very uncomfortable with silence unless I actually get them into the habit of requiring them to be silent when they've read something that we're going to have now 2 minutes of silence. Well, that's all right. But if we're having a discussion class, and I ask the question, lots of people will leap in to fill the space with anything just to keep the space filled.
Right.
Not that they have anything particularly pertinent to say.
Right.
Just because they can't stand for there to be more than about 15 seconds of silence in the class because they somehow think that's a failure or embarrassing or they're very ill at ease with the silence.
And I just want to ask a question as we consider this sort of discomfort with silence in our culture. Is it something human beings are discomforted about Or is it something that our culture shapes us to be concerned about? And partly I ask this because I think of within the Christian tradition, one could talk about Quakers as having a culture of silence and sort of expecting silence first before speech. But I think also there are other cultures and native traditions that honor silence before speaking as a way to say, well, something I'm going to say is important. Actually, Betsy Branch, who's on teaching staff leading music, was talking about Japanese students that she works with teaching English as a second language. And it's not a question by thinking carefully about your response to the question. But as you're saying, Mark, it's not so common in our society to be asked a question and then sort of just wait. Mm-hmm. Then people, I think, would make the assumption you're not listening.
Yeah, Ruth. I was curious about what you were saying about the prelude is taken as a time of silence in worship. I'm a musician, so that's an issue with me. Because, for instance, up here, like last night at the Vespers, there was music going constantly during what was essentially a silent part of the service. And I have participated in liturgies and services of different kinds where it really was quiet. But I think that does our culture prepare us for this? We don't like it to be completely quiet anymore. So this kind of new agey piano playing that is constant, there's never any silence in this piano playing. Every chord is spelled, the arpeggios go and go and go. It never stops. That is a style of music that is coming into the church now. And it comes from the popular culture, I believe. But it's very different from what music used to be. It wasn't always filled in like that all the time. And yet I think the overall effect on us is that we think of that as a silent time in worship. It's almost like I have students who study in their rooms with music on all the time.
How can they say
they always have music on, but they're not listening to it. Mm-hmm. It functions as white noise mm-hmm. in the background for them. And if they don't have that music on, they say they can't study. It's like the silence is too loud.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And living in a city, as I have for much of my life, in a large city, I know people that get white noise machines and have them running in their apartments so that there's noise going all the time, which somewhat obliterates the city sounds, but creates a sound of their own. There's never silence.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree, because I find in my life, the minute I walk in the house, I either turn the radio on, I have it set so it just plays music, I either turn that on, or I go and I turn the TV on, then I get busy and do my things, and you could call and ask me what's on TV, and I wouldn't know, but I hear that sound of... And then I think, well, maybe it's because I have been so busy in my life that I just don't like silence.
As a musician, I sometimes feel very offended uh-huh. that the work of my profession is to fill in silence. that people aren't really listening to what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That they study to what I do, or they read, or they talk. And you find that at concerts sometimes, that people sit there making all kinds of noise while you are doing something that you think is a very intimate communication.
Yeah.
But they're not really listening. I know in our house, we began several years ago, we never answer the phone. We always have a machine pick it up, and now we've turned off the ringer. And we never have the radio going during dinner or when we're together as a family. We just stopped doing that because it was just like bees going around your head all the time. And I frankly feel that way at church. And I'm the musician. I'm the one that's supposed to be providing all that sound, and it bothers me.
Sure.
Yeah. For instance, Wade Clark Ruth wrote a very, very popular sociological study of the baby boom generation called The Generation of Seekers. And in that book, he argues that the baby boom generation, sort of born between the late 1940s and the early 1960s, are shaped by rock music. Mm-hmm. And so they're the, and by the 60s. And so this is a generation of people who like a music with a beat, and they like experiential things. And so the, this sociological study of a generation has been adopted by worship planners, who now argue that for worship to be done in a way that reaches this generation, it has to draw on the view of music and experiential participation that this generation has lived in their lives. So they call silence dead air time. Mm-hmm. And dead air time allows people to become bored and check out, their minds wander. And so in worship, you always want to keep something happening, keep the pace up, change the channel frequently, have commercials. There's a very interesting proposal about how silence should be a part of worship in relationship to the culture.
You think about like spirituality, I've been trying to work on that, just being sitting, you know, and being silent, read a Bible verse or something, and then sit and be silent. But my goodness, you know, I think I've sat for an hour, you know, and probably 5 minutes have gone by.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or otherwise my mind is just going from one thing to another. I don't think we know how to be silent.
Yeah.
Oh, it takes discipline.
Yeah, interesting. It takes discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To try and be silent and not, you know, it's,
yeah.
I find it difficult.
Yeah.
It also works in strange ways historically. For instance, when St. Augustine finds St. Jerome reading silently, he's completely blown away because people didn't read for centuries silently. This was thought to be a kind of magical and astonishing thing that someone could sit in front of a book and not speak the words. The reading was done for centuries out loud because it came out so connected to an oral tradition of people listening to those stories first. But then, of course, if they read them on a piece of paper, they would say them out loud. And so that kind of silence, that kind of inward life where you were just sitting before a book, people at first thought that this was very dangerous and practically demonic to be able to do that. That kind of silence was thought to be very fearful. At the other extreme, it's interesting that as soon as we get, quote, silent films, we immediately have to have them shown with a piano, for instance, and so forth, and have music to the background. So we call them silent films, but we couldn't stand to just look at images.
Right.
And now, often it's the musical score that will carry you through long stretches of film when there's no talking. You think no one's talking and there's no noise, but it's people who win Academy Awards, Ennio Morricone, for carrying the dramatic action through the music in these stretches of film. So I use those examples just to say it's a very perplexing, a very perplexing issue, this whole question of silence.
Yes.
There's some branches of the Christian faith that don't seem to believe that the ordinary human can be spoken to by God.
Uh-huh.
Since he is the creator of the universe, he doesn't really want to bother with any of us little people. So some people, I think, have grown to fear the voice of God. Mm-hmm. And the best way to keep God from speaking to you is to fill your head with anything that you can fill it with.
Huh.
Because the minute there is a complete silence, he's going to be talking to you.
Huh.
And he's going to expect you to listen. So you've got a really good excuse if you've got all this noise around you, or you can fill your head with thoughts.
Yeah.
Then you can't hear him, so you don't have to worry about what he's going to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a helpful point about our relationship with God. It also is very similar in terms of our relationship to other people. It's hard to hear what another person is saying if you're distracted and listening to all sorts of different things. Well, let's take your comment as an opportunity to shift gears a little bit and look at the question of silence and worship. And I earlier mentioned the witness of the Quakers as let's see where I am here. The witness of the Quakers is one very strong model in the history of the church, honor and silence first, and speech coming out of that. But I think it's actually quite mundane in worship, if we think about it for a minute, because every word or every note of music depends on silence for the word or the note of music to be heard. So in one way, silence has to be a part of our worship. And it's a question of how we choose to actively use it. And I think the Quakers have given a strong model that's very different, countercultural, from what we've described as being a major discomfort with silence in our culture. But I also think there's a strong history of Christian monastics, Christian contemplatives who go either into monasteries or into the desert, into the mountains, and go there exactly, as you were saying, to get away from the competing messages and find a place to be silent in order to hear God. And so that's another witness from the tradition about honoring silence. And there are also ways, explicitly in our worship services, that silence is set aside, or at least time is set aside for silence. And although I think some of us probably don't use the Lutheran Book of Worship for worship, I wanted to look at the Lutheran Book of Worship and see where, in fact, they officially recommend silence and see if anyone has noted that practice in their congregation. And if you don't use the LBW, then please mention the places where that happens in your service. But let's just look for a minute at the LBW and see where they recommend silence. We can just start with the first setting, which I think begins on page 55 and in the beginning, 56. The first place, not all churches begin the Sunday worship service with a brief order for confession and forgiveness, but those who do, there's a moment for silence and self-examination in the middle of the page 56, right before the confession. Now that seems to make sense, that before confession one would think about what to confess. So that's one. And is that something that you experience, those of you who use the Lutheran Book of Worship? Do your congregations do this? How about how long do you think the moment of silence is?
Sometimes it isn't long enough.
Yeah.
You know, you just are just getting into asking for forgiveness for something, and then they start in right away. So, I mean, sometimes it isn't long enough. Hmm.
Is there a turn segment suggested to the liturgists?
Not officially, no. The minister's desk edition, as it's called, which has notes on how to lead the liturgy, doesn't suggest a certain length of time. Although I'm sure there's popular lore about the pastor should, you know, in order to not charge ahead, the pastor should count 1,000, 2,000.
Right.
How do other people experience this moment of silence? Yes?
We have a silence before the service for prayers and confession.
Yeah. But you don't use this order of confession and forgiveness, yeah?
Mm-hmm. About
how long do you think the silence is?
It varies anywhere from about 3 minutes to 10 minutes.
Wow.
But it's an individual, it's an Anglo-Catholic church, so it's an individual thing. When a person comes in, you can have this mentioned to me when I visited a new church. This lady says, well, obviously you must belong here because you know what to do. Huh. Because you come in and you kneel right away when you find a seat, you kneel right away and you say your prayers and your confession and keep a few minutes of silence.
Yeah.
So before the service starts.
Yeah. So that's the beginning of people's participation in the worship, as they come in themselves and kneel and
Right. Even if you come in the middle of the service, that's still expected that you will do that.
Interesting. Well, what would be your guess, before we turn to it, what the next place where silence is recommended in the service? Can you think of a spot where that would be?
After the readings.
After the readings. It seems logical that you would have silence after the reading in order to sort of sit with the reading for a minute.
No, it doesn't suggest it.
But it doesn't suggest it there. The actual next moment where they recommend silence is after the sermon. Silence for reflect on page 63. Silence for reflection may follow. And the red instructions in this book always use is if it's considered a requirement, and always use may if it's considered an optional practice. How many people experience a purposeful period of silence either after the readings or after the sermon in their worship services? No?
We're supposed to remember this.
What would you think if there was a substantial silence after the readings or after the sermon?
You know, I think that people are pretty uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
They're looking to see how long the service will be.
Yeah.
They, in general, I'm aware of people timing the sermon.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, this is a long one, we're not going to get out of here on time.
Yeah.
And on so time. This silence here is more bothersome than others. They want to go right into the hymn.
Yeah. Interesting. So this is a. We talked first about the hidden language of time, and I think that's one very strong way that time impacts our use of silence in the service. That's an interesting point. Yeah.
And typically, unless it's in the direction somewhere, you know, the silence is coming.
Right.
I think, something got messed up here.
Something's wrong.
Somebody forgot to read, or,
yeah.
You know, who's going to cover this?
Right.
You know,
right.
And that's about 5 seconds, you know,
because
there's no movement, so, you know, it's like, oh, what's happening?
Yeah, who's next?
Yeah.
That's interesting. So that would suggest that because of what we talked about in terms of our culture, if we're going to include a moment of silence in the service, it requires some preparation so that people don't assume that and are allowed, you know, you sort of alert them if you would like to, you know, enjoy this moment of silence and use it for meditation.
Yeah, so it's helpful when, you know, like you're following along here, then you know that's what it's for, and you can relax, and otherwise it creates some tension, I think.
Yeah.
Just have it here.
Yeah. There's one other moment of silence recommended. Another unusual thing I've never experienced it here particularly. It's not after communion, but it's after the post-communion prayer. The communion would finish, and then the hymn after communion, and then the prayer after that on page 74. And then they suggest silence for reflection. And that would be right before the benediction, the blessing at the end of the service. Have people experienced a notable silence for reflection at that point in the service? No.
It doesn't say may or is.
No. Silence for reflection. Yeah, so that's more directive there.
Yeah.
There's an expectation that will happen. I belonged to a church for a number of years where there was an extended period of silence after everyone had communed. And every Sunday it was like that. And at the end of that period of silence, the minister had a big bowl sitting on a cushion up on the side of the altar and a rubber mallet, and he would hit that bowl 3 times slowly and just let it reverberate. And I don't know all the images that people and meanings that people associated with that, but it, what it did was it created a ritual closure, an expected closure to the end of silence. And so we all knew that communion would take as long as it took for everyone to eat, and then everyone to sit down and have a period of reflection. So after the last person sat down, which was usually the pastor because he communed last, then we all knew that there would be a period of silence, a couple of minutes. And until we heard those gongs, we knew that we could sit in that silence. So there was something I thought very helpful about that. It wasn't written instructions, and it wasn't verbal instructions, but nonetheless, there was a way to instruct people about when the silence was ending, and it wasn't abrupt either. It was easing into the next section of the service by the length of those gongs. So that's a very unusual, in my experience in church, that's a very unusual practice of silence. And it allowed me, I think, to not become anxious about how many people there still were left to go through the communion line. I knew that even when everyone had eaten, we still weren't going to move on, so I might as well just sit down and do something else, meditate.
And did you have hymns during the communion? Because maybe we did.
But the hymns ended when the eating ended.
It seems like the hymns during communion, they're kind of a distraction as well from the whole ritual.
Huh. Interesting. Yes?
Well, that's for growing up, and I guess the first third of my life, I thought that after communion was a time to go quietly and give prayers of thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
But I think that the mood is different now in the church, that's a time of celebration and rejoicing, and people should almost be dancing back. And I think that it's interesting. We sing, "Let all mortal flesh keep silence." After communion, huh?
Yeah,
or during communion.
And there's another communion hymn now, "The Silence." Is that the name of it?
Well, now.
Right.
That isn't in here.
Well, a couple of interesting things I think we've discovered. One is that although silence in our culture is a complicated phenomenon, there is a certain discomfort with silence. We're not shaped into easy experience of silence, a beneficial experience of silence, except for sort of minority groups who have that as a discipline in their community. And I think you're absolutely right to say it's a discipline to learn to use silence. And so there is a sort of busyness, a loudness to our culture. And our worship, both by its absence of significant silence and teaching us the discipline of silence, and by adopting, as you were saying, Bruce, and as others said, adopting things from our culture that are sort of hyped, that fill in the silences, we don't learn so well how to use silence or how to honor silence. And so we're shaped by an absence of silence or discomfort with silence. And given that context, I wanted to take you a few minutes to think together. Now, I'm sure not everyone has read this, read the summer theme book, Practicing Our Faith, but really they're suggesting that these are ordinary things that communities do together, that are a part of Christian life. And so I don't think that, even if you haven't read the book, I don't think they'll be obscure to you, most of them. And I just wanted to think for a minute what we lose if we don't know how to use silence, if silence isn't a discipline in our lives, in terms of doing these sorts of practices well. Are there things, as you look up here, that you think really would require silence? Yeah.
You said something earlier about how in music it depends on the silence between the notes to give a definition.
Yeah.
Well, I've often thought that, in fact, as a technique for singing well or having a choir sing well, you deal with the silences. They're very important. And I think music in the service or any kind of music loses meaning because there's always sound. And that if you have silence and then you choose to sing, then the words that you're singing carry a lot more meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the melody, the notes that you choose that are written have a lot more meaning. If you have this constant going on all the time, then it has no significance.
Mm-hmm.
It has no meaning. And this the axe I grind as a musician, but, you know, singing is pretty biblical. I mean, people have been using the language of music as the language of worship from the very beginning.
Right.
Just talking that they do with each other, but when it comes to singing, that's the language of worship. But we have singing of some kind around us that is deafening us constantly.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it, some of it pretty, some of it ugly, but none of it very significant.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would really take more disciplined silence for us to think about what we're singing.
Yeah.
Or what that implies,
yeah,
in projection.
Yeah. And I think embedded in your point is that singing as a part of Christian worship is also not just making noise, but singing certain songs with certain content that,
yeah,
we consider important. So it's not just the singing, but also what we're singing, the Psalms,
yeah,
being a good example.
What you said earlier about how hymns during communion can be bothersome, can distract you from the Eucharist. I think that's very true. But if they're chosen well, and there's silence surrounding them, and you sing, O Bread of Life from Heaven, or if you sing certain things where the texts clearly elucidate the liturgical action, I think it tends to focus people.
Yeah.
Singing, I think of as the language of worship, and if you are singing, it puts you in a different plane. Puts you in a different frame of mind and body and then spirit to be singing. But if it's just all singing, then it's just pablum. It's,
mm-hmm,
it has no meaning.
Yeah, that's very thoughtful.
And I'm just sitting here thinking that silence doesn't necessarily mean to really be quiet. When I think of like keeping the Sabbath there,
mm-hmm,
it would be silent from, like you said, you had no phone or anything. You were with your family, and to me, this would be kind of a silence from all the outside world. And your testimony, I hope that I walk my talk so people will know that I love the Lord,
mm-hmm,
without saying. You know, and sometimes you can just tell on people too. They don't have to shout that, you know, but you can tell in their lives. It's a silent message,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, the ancient word martyr is the word for witness, the,
uh-huh,
word for testimony. So in fact, with their bodies, with their actions,
mm-hmm,
they were giving
and
testimony.
And it's the same way like in the service too, like the pastor says, the Lord be with you, and we should respond and also with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the hands are a silent message,
mm-hmm,
to the pastor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes?
I totally agree with his definition of singing, that it's the language of worship. And in the same way, I think that silence is the language of healing.
Hmm. Interesting. How does that work in healing?
It brings a concentration on focusing what exactly needs to be healed.
Huh.
When there's so much going on in your head and in the space around you, you don't even know what needs to be healed.
Hmm.
You have to focus in on just exactly what is the problem here,
yeah,
or problems. You know, how many of them can I actually deal with, and how many of them the Lord's going to have to take care of because I couldn't possibly fix them.
Hmm.
And you need silence for that. And the more you move into a silent mode, the more you can sort these things out without all this outside interference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very valuable tool for not only healing, but for learning how to live well.
Yeah.
And you have dying well up there, but in order to live well,
yeah,
you need the silences in between to punctuate your life just as you need silences to punctuate the music.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, too, you know, we're so busy. We don't sometimes don't do things well because we got to touch a little bit on this, a little bit on that. And sometimes I find that, no, I'm going to do this one thing and do it well and get it done. Yeah. Take one step at a time, but a lot of times we're just crowding in, and that's why I love to come to Holden.
Yeah.
Because it shuts off that, and I can just be, you know, without all,
yeah,
you know, all these things to do, and sometimes I just get, so I just almost want to scream sometimes, because I volunteer a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm just going, and my house is a mess, and oh, you know, I mean, but you know, so then sometimes you think, I think, well, now I have to just stop. Mm-hmm. Based on what's important,
yeah.
What do I do?
And what you're saying, there's a real connection between time and uh-huh. how we use time, yeah, and our ability to have moments of silence. Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, stop and just think, well, what am I doing? Where am I going?
Yeah. I experienced that too. I live in Atlanta, in the downtown Atlanta. And there's two sort of, over time, two things that really start to get to me. One is that it's never dark. It's never, ever dark. And number two, it's never quiet. We live next to partly it's because of where we live. We live next to the subway, and across the tracks from the subway is the train, and there's cars at all hours, and buses, and
lights people are always on.
Yeah, so really I have to go physically somewhere else every once in a while for me to remember what real silence is, where I can't hear anything, or what real darkness is and what stars look like.
All you have to do is go down in a cave and have them turn the lights off.
Yeah.
That's dark.
Yeah. Go in a music practice room with soundproofing.
Yeah.
Other reflection about, yes.
One that strikes me that needs sound is probably discernment.
Yeah.
You know, so you can hear God's will or God's direction. And it struck me in the chapter that they talked about the Quaker method of group discernment,
right,
where they would go back to silence, and you know, they had to, if I recall right, they had to get unanimous vote to make decisions, and if they didn't have it, then they, rather than the people that felt most strongly about it getting up and, you know, restating their case, they would go to silence, and then they would come back to vote again and see, you know, see what discernment they were getting. So,
yeah,
see, that's required in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not, I think about the forum last night and Mark talking about the difference between sort of talk show debate versus conversation. And not only do the people in a talk show type format not have to live with each other the next day, but they don't necessarily even have to listen because they're invited to give their opinion. And so it's really not essential to that for them to listen to what anyone else has to say. So that can lead to a mode of interaction where one spends the time when someone else is talking preparing the next thing that you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And in discernment, it really requires that I be silent so that I can hear what you have to say. I think that's a real key point, especially when congregations are as contentious and difficult and political as any place else you go in our society. And so, I mean, it's a gift that the church should have to offer, I think, to society, that we care enough about community shaping community that we're willing to be quiet and listen to what others have to say so that we can do that sort of discernment process together.
Well, as well as understanding that the church is God's, it's not ours.
Yeah.
So we've got to get his direction.
Yeah.
And how do we get that?
Yeah.
You know, when you've got the group dynamics and the normal political processes going on.
Yeah.
Where do you stop and say, okay, what does God want us to do in this?
And that's really the if you want to think about it this way, the Quakers sitting together in silence are really proclaiming something, because what they're proclaiming is that we believe if we sit here together in silence, we'll understand more deeply what God would have us do. So there, it's really a trusting posture, saying God will speak to us.
And it's very purposeful.
Yeah, it's powerful.
I just had a thought here about silence. You know, my husband used to get real angry with me, and he probably wouldn't talk to me for a week. And that silence would just, you know, drive me up a wall.
Yeah, silence as a sort of power tool.
Yeah, You know, and it's,
I think Koreans practice that. If there's somebody they don't like, they just cut them off with silence. I heard that in the Korean culture. And I've worked with Koreans, and sometimes I didn't know what was going on. This person just didn't speak to me.
Right, it's terrible.
It's
awful. Because you try and talk, and you know, nothing, you couldn't break that silence.
Give them a silent treatment.
Yeah.
But that's interesting, because that's silence that's actually
a
message.
Yeah, same, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever it said.
Another thing related to this, I find that if you're in the fast lane, which I guess a lot of us are when we're not up here, and you've got a lot of responsibility, a lot of interconnected responsibilities coming at you all the time, and you're working at a very high energy level, you do lose perspective. I think of this most directly, like if I'm conducting a big rehearsal and it's before a concert and everybody has all these questions and all these concerns and so forth and so on, I've learned I have to say, during the break, don't talk to me. I just have to be quiet and then talk to somebody else who can bring your concern to me so that I can think about it quietly and deal with it.
Yeah.
That has to do with discernment, has to do with saying yes and no, has to do with shaping community. That the more pressured you are, the harder it is, but the more necessary it becomes to wall yourself off in a silent place where you can keep your proportions and your perspective appropriately.
Yeah.
I've for myself found that to be just a very important discipline.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I have a similar kind of situation with the high stress life, it's, you know, in general. And I'm studying meditation. And when you said that about the discipline, there's a wonderful book called A Path with Heart by Jack Kornfield. And one of the first chapters about the mind is, he makes the analogy of training the puppy. You know, and that the mind is like the puppy, that we have to keep gently bringing back, that we don't whip it back, or we don't, you know, yell at it, or we don't, you know, punish it, because that's not how you would bring that puppy to, but that we, in a sense, our mind, our wandering mind can do that, and that even learning that 5 minutes, taking and learning how to focus in that 5 minutes, even though you may have to come back 20 times or 100 times or however many times, that's part of it. And that, but even that short time, it doesn't have to be, you know, hours and hours of deep meditation. It can be a 10 or 15 minute break. It can be very refreshing and give us that discernment and energy and clarity to continue and not be overwhelmed by life and noise and responsibilities and pressure, and that's the healing aspect. But it does take. We're not as a society. I don't believe that we know how to do silence well, you know, and that it does take some. It takes focus. And it takes some education and practicing.
Yeah.
And that you're not just automatically going to know how to do that.
Right. Thank you. Well, we're at time, so I thank all of you for coming and for the wonderful insights, and invite you to keep reflecting about it and talking about it, even though the formal discussion stops at an hour.